Hello.
Talk a little louder.
Hello.
Yeah, okay, I guess we're on. Go for it. Après-vous, man.
I'm gearing up mentally. There we go. Welcome to Mustard Mayonnaise. I'm Matt.
And I am Richard.
And we talk about things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest, or at least engage it briefly.
This is true.
Capturing is perhaps overstating. And this is the first one since we're now available on the iTunes directory.
Yeah, wasn't that cool to see our little the little logo? And
is it searchable yet? I haven't actually...
You know, it is, but I'll tell you, there's one thing we have to do that's screwed up. You'd think, okay, mustard is short for mustard mayonnaise. If you type mustard, it would come up. Nope. It's got to be mustard mayonnaise, which nobody knows how to spell.
Depends on their search algorithm. I wouldn't think...
No, I'm talking about on... If you go to the iTunes site, if you type in mustard, you get four different... things that none of them are us, and they all have the word exactly mustard. I think what we're going to have to do is, like in our album title, we're going to have to spell it mustard and ayonnaise, because that way it'll come up. So, yeah, believe it or not. But anyway, it's there, especially if you know exactly how to spell the complicated word, nonsensical word, mustard, ayonnaise.
I didn't think people couldn't spell mayonnaise, but apparently. So we should be on our game, this one.
Absolutely.
This perhaps will be the first time... We should send that email out to the friends and family this week. Hey, please listen to us.
Exactly.
Some vaguely non-pathetic way.
Yeah, I'm getting tired of begging. It's a little embarrassing.
All right. Was there any other introductory?
Nah. What's on your list, dude?
All right. One day last week, I see that you send me three different stories about TiVo and Dish.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like, I get these later in the afternoon, I'm click, click, click. I'm Richard. Ah!
Well, I was looking at them, and then I realized, there was different news to them. It was like evolving through the day because they were different news stories. Basically, the first one.
I was all over it.
Well, the first one, I had no idea. I didn't know if you were aware
of course,
of
that's the problem when we send each other emails. We never know what we've seen. It's like, exactly. Oh, have you seen this? Of course I've seen it, you idiot. Or, no, thanks for sending that to me. And there's no way to distinguish.
Exactly. So, well, but it was a story. It was that Dish Network, because Dish Network had created their own PVR, and apparently TiVo's been suing them, and apparently not only is TiVo somewhat winning this case, but they got an injunction against Dish TV to actually not only stop selling them, but actually turn off the service for existing customers.
Most of them, something like 30,000, could continue using for some reason.
That's weird.
But
and correct me if I'm not or if I'm wrong. You are a Dish TV customer, and you have the PVR.
And then they got to stay on that.
Yeah, and that was the other
later.
News.
That was the third email you sent me was the stay. I have no idea if I'm affected. I would imagine so. But what's confusing to me is why just Dish? Because Comcast, there's a lot of these boxes now have the time shifting capability. My buddy Just High Def box, cable box, records shows, lets him fast forward, lets him rewind. I don't know if he has a button that skips ahead 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Maybe that is the sole factor in TiVo's being irritated with them.
That's a good question. Or maybe they are plugging through each one of them with lawsuits.
I don't know what Dish does that's so special that they're drawing TiVo's ire and not anyone else's.
You know, the weird
that would really, really piss me off
if
I didn't have that system anymore.
You know, the weird thing, though, is I've seen other ones.
DirecTV has their own box now. They still sell the TiVo version for now. But I mean,
they just got DirecTV just got tired, or more oracular, Rupert Murdoch.
But I mean, they've been partners for a while,
But DirecTV's hated that because. But the irony is having, you know, my dad had DirecTV everything and TiVo everywhere, and I've used other systems, and none of them, I'm telling you, even come close to TiVo. Somehow they figured out just how to do it right. And so I agree with you on the one level. It's like, wait a second, they have these other systems. Why aren't they suing them? But the one thing about it is, to me, DirecTV clearly said, because they pay like $1 a customer a month for these things, and they don't want to pay that dollar. And I'm thinking, God, as a customer, TiVo is so good compared to other PVRs that I'd be willing to pay probably $5 to $10, and DirecTV's nickel and diming them for $1. The thing that they're replacing with, it doesn't even compare remotely to how great TiVo is. So it's just weird and frustrating.
Have you seen a newer DirecTV box?
Yes, because okay. I went down and tested one out down at was it Best Buy or Comp or Computer City, where there's a weird lag in it that isn't inherent in TiVo.
And you're sure it's the new one?
Oh yeah, definitely okay. Sure. And then the other problem with it is I don't know, TiVo, you know, TiVo, their remotes, they, from what I understand, they're sort of like Apple. They spent an enormous amount on the user interface and the look and feel of it. They've got that remote, they call it the peanut remote, because it fits so perfectly in your hand, and you just know using your thumb where everything is. They had a mandate when they created these to only have like 20 buttons on them, and you can just tell they've done that, because you see some of these other PVRs, and I look at my horrible cable modem from Comcast, or cable remote, and it's a mess. I can never figure anything out on the thing. TiVo, you just literally within 20 minutes, you know everything, and you don't have to look at the remote anymore.
I've never had a problem with the dish remote, but it's not that derivative. But yeah. The reason I keep asking about, is it the latest? You know, you go to Best Buy, I don't know if it's still the case, but I would go to Best Buy and see, I don't know if they do Dish and DirecTV, but they'd have the high definition receivers for mm-hmm. satellite, and you'd look at them and they'd be, and I would know, because I'm a dork about this stuff, I would know that these are not the MPEG-4 boxes.
Yeah.
It's like you're selling the MPEG-2 box, which is not compatible with the new high def signal they're beaming down.
Yeah.
How much you want to bet if someone goes to buy that box, a Best Buy employee is not going to tell them, oh, by the way, if you wait a month or two, you'll get a next generation box with a better signal, with less compression.
And I'll tell you, the thing about that, thing about DirecTV and TiVo is TiVo basically, like all of them, they work by copying the signal and compressing it, you know, so it can fit on a hard drive, and then replaying it. And it's not really noticeable any artifacting, if that's a word, on your regular TV. But the minute you get a higher def version of a TV, it looks atrocious, looks awful. And the new TiVo, the old ones used to be able to set the quality level, but you can't now. And it looks atrocious. So for no other...
That might be specific to what you've seen. I've got a friend who has TiVo DirecTV set up,
yeah.
and he has a high def projector. Now, he's not looking at a high def signal. He's looking at a standard def signal.
Maybe the newer ones. I'm thinking of my dad's older one, and it looks awful. All I know is, for me, I'm not monkeying on any of it until they throw their new satellites up, because they're throwing
up
DirecTV a bunch of...
Well, the DirecTV high def, the MPEG-4 high def boxes is supposed to now be coming out in the fall.
So are they going to... They're going to
Dish has had theirs out for a little while now.
And they're going to be compatible with the new satellites.
Yeah. The difference is MPEG-2 versus MPEG-4. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm waiting. I'm ultimately...
You can get a Dish one right now. DirecTV, you cannot, but very soon. And I was going to ask you, because you've said repeatedly you were going to ditch cable because you can get almost everything you need from the internet.
Yeah.
Where are you in that process?
Well, I'm kind of...
You're equivocating.
I'm about ready to get rid of it, but our mutual friend Holly wants to come over and watch a bunch of Howard Stern stuff that has been accumulating on the Howard TV channel on video on demand. One of the few benefits of cable is that you can order specialty channels like the Howard TV channel, and it's good stuff, and she wanted to come over and see it, so I'm kind of waiting for her to come over and see it, then I'm going to get rid of it.
Oh, okay. We'll see.
So that's the only honestly thing. I sort of promised her we would, and now I have to, you know, wait till she gets here. But other than that, I will get rid of it, and then I probably will get DirecTV maybe next year, but that's a complicated process that includes cutting one of my trees in my backyard in half.
Yeah, and that's rough. I mean, my friend, the reason he has a standard def signal instead of a high def signal is he's on the wrong side of a hill to get over the air channels from Seattle.
Yeah.
And he can't to get to the high def satellite really doesn't work from where he is because he's surrounded by trees, and he can't for some reason get a waiver from Comcast to get high def locals. There's some bizarre legal reason, and he's pretty pissed about it. And maybe it's not that Comcast, he couldn't get a waiver from Dish or DirecTV, and he really, really, really doesn't want to do Comcast because he hates them almost as much as I do. Anyway, doesn't matter. Moving on. This is just a small thing. I was driving to work last week and listening to the local NPR station, and one of their sponsors is Little Miss Sunshine.
Yep.
And so you hear the announcer going through the spiel, and he says, starring Greg Kinnear, Steve Carroll.
Steve Carroll.
and you know, it's one of those things,
That would kill if I was Steve Carroll, because you think, God, I'm a big star now in all those movies, and they're still mispronouncing it.
But what's funny is, on the ride home, they had corrected it by then.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Carell. And I thought that was really funny that, you know, they had noticed it, got, you know, I don't know if the voiceover guys, I know he does evenings there.
Yeah.
Bill O'Grady, he does the voices for all the announcements. So I don't know if they had him come in early or what. I just thought
that was funny. Did you notice it did, 93% on the tomato meter?
That's awesome.
That is good. And when you think about it, it's about the highest reviewed movie of the year. And it's funny because I love the movie. You and I both loved it, but I've been like sensing in some of the other long lead reviews that there's to some extent a certain percentage of critics that weren't going to like it, but nope, not the case. They're definitely liking this movie. So, and is it out this weekend or is it next when it goes wide?
I think it's this weekend. I mean,
it feels so long ago since we saw the thing.
Yeah. We went to a special screening,
but it's so,
By the amount of internet advertising and the fact that they were sponsoring the radio stuff, I would guess it opened this weekend.
You know, I'll tell you, it's funny. And I saw them do it on about 5 different blogs and sites that they chose to advertise on, which I just think is funny and semi-clever. They have ads on both sides of the copy. So you see the bus on one side, bus on the other. And I don't know why. I just really like this particular internet advertising campaign. Speaking of internet advertising campaigns, I saw Snakes on a Plane on Friday.
Hold on. Before we go there,
yep.
My favorite Flash movie ads, I think, of all time, and perhaps most people's, if they'd stop to think about it, The Real Cancun.
I don't remember those ads.
You go to Ain't It Cool News, and there's Flash pictures of chicks, hard body chicks in swimsuits. That was their entire campaign, was the promise of softcore porn.
Boy, it didn't work, though. That thing made about $2 million in the theater.
That was but it was the best advertising campaign to look at while you're looking at movie stuff.
This is true.
Okay, so Snakes on a Plane.
Well,
I
told you that I was in Cancun. When,
we've talked about that, but I just wanted to talk. You said campaign. I wanted to relate.
Okay. I was just mentioning in case others hadn't heard. I just found that amazing that
we've talked about it on the podcast.
Oh, I was going to bring it up for the odd person. We've had one listener maybe for some of these episodes.
I try and be aware of stuff we've talked about before.
Okay. Well, I would like to mention, since I brought it up, that I thought it was amazing when that movie came out that we flew into Cancun 4 days after they finished wrapping that movie, and when we came back to Seattle, it opened the next day. It took them 2 weeks to put that movie, cut it, and put it in the theater. I found that stunning. Too bad it was a horrible piece of crap, but I digress. So anyway, Snakes on a Plane. So we saw this thing on Friday. I would have no interest in seeing it, although ironically, I had talked about the campaign so much that our mutual friend Mark was like all of a sudden all interested in it, and I realized, oh God, he didn't understand me talking about the buzz about it was not actually reflective of me having any interest in the movie, because I had none.
That's funny.
But my brother and niece wanted to see it, so, and my brother got all into it, and I thought, well, what the hell, they wanted to see it, and I work near where they live, so we saw it afterwards, and there wasn't many people in theater. I heard it did okay. It wasn't it wasn't a horrible movie. It was just, it was dumb. It pretty much did it was as advertised. I think the thing that was, there was a number of stuff that you're just thinking, boy, in other hands, it would have been better. The action was pretty poorly put together, and the effects were not really good. The snakes never particularly looked really good. And there's a whole lot of, you know, snakes can be an exceptionally creepy animal if done right in a movie, and somehow in this movie they weren't done right.
Anaconda.
Well, Anaconda had some scenes in there were actually pretty good. But anyway, so it was. But that said, it was funny in certain areas, and parts that were just things were just left unspoken. But for the most part, it wasn't horrible. It kind of delivered what it said. But I think it was interesting the critical reaction, how the critics were gunning for this so much. And then I thought the most incredible thing happened. They decided to not show it to critics. And that became the big focus of the story, because they're saying, well, it didn't have anything to do with the quality of it. And I got the impression that critics mass almost, even though they decided not to show it to critics, of course, every critic went to go see it. I get the feeling reading the reviews that a lot of critics are giving this movie a bigger pass than it deserves, because it's not a particularly good movie. It basically should get a thumbs down, although it was somewhat entertaining, but it got like a 62-63% on the tomato meter. Totally undeserved. Now, it doesn't even remotely, you know, it's basically a piece of crud little movie that is pretty entertaining in some areas.
Did you see the Sam Jackson interview on The Daily Show last week?
No. Oh, yeah, I did.
I thought great interview.
Yeah.
A really good balance of actually asking interesting questions and people having fun.
Yep.
Because a lot of times, especially when actors go on The Daily Show, it's just like 5 minutes of them laughing at each other. And you're like, hey, that was funny, but you could have actually done a better job. Anyway, this Jackson interview was really good. And Jackson, I thought, did a good job of encompassing the making of the film and sort of how it came to be.
Yeah, it was cool. They went into the background of the one director that got canned and then the other director.
And you can see how, you know, it was being committed to death.
Yeah.
It's like, well, the whole point of this, the whole catch of this movie is the title.
Yep.
It encompasses everything you need to know, and that's how they get the director interested, that's how they get Sam Jackson interested, and then the studio immediately wants to start watering it down, saying, oh... And finally, Jackson making a stink, saying, no, the whole point of this is the title and what that encompasses. And you can't, and it sounds like the first director was completely into that, and they fired him, and they brought the second director on, who was kind of into it, but wanted to play ball.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's I have no desire to see it. I hate snakes. I don't care how badly done they are. I don't want to see them.
Well, you know, one of the things that I thought was funny is, famously, they went back and put more violence and more sex and nudity in, or whatever. And then there's this couple that is on the plane that does have sex and nudity in it. And the more I thought about it, I was trying to figure out, God, I wonder if their entire characters were added later. Because I started to realize that I'm not sure if I remember them actually interacting with anybody else. They're these two characters that go and basically join the Mile High Club and get killed
right
doing that. And I started to realize maybe I'm wrong in this, but I don't actually remember them interacting. And I almost think they might have filmed them and filmed them against other extras on the same sets just to throw that whole subplot.
Sure, why not?
But anyway, though, you know, the best thing about this, the screening Samuel Jackson wise, was the preview for his new movie, also with a snake in the title, Black Snake Moan. And have you heard about this movie?
I might have.
So they had a preview for this, and I haven't found it on the internet. And it's a movie with Christina Ricci, and it's directed by the guy who directed Hustle and Flow. And it's a really, really good preview. It's basically about this girl who shows up on Samuel Jackson. He looks like a sharecropper, shows up on his doorstep, and she's like this tramp. And then they kind of, the trailer switches gears. It does a really good job in 2 minutes of telling a lot, and it starts out kind of like a drama about her being this over sexualized nubile young girl and how she's crazy, and then it cuts into, then you realize, oh, a lot of this movie is actually a comedy where he's going to put the fear of the Lord into her and get her to understand her ways. But
that does sound interesting.
But it looked funny, it looked cool, it looked, you know, Christina Ricci looks hot.
What was it rated?
It's definitely an R movie.
I was gonna say, well, then you probably get to see Christina Ricci's boobies.
If we're lucky, and she looks, you know, she's another one of those gals that vacillates on her weight, and when she loses weight, she gets massive bobblehead. And like last year, you know, all those actresses like Nicole Richie and everything, and they're just killing themselves.
See Nicole Richie?
Yeah, Nicole. Yeah, like Nicole Richie. You know, the gal from The Simple Life. How she used to be, you know, a little chunky, and then all of a sudden she's like 75 pounds.
At first, I thought you meant Nicole Kidman and had made a mistake.
No.
And then you say The Simple Life, and I'm talking about. I didn't watch The Simple Life.
Well, I didn't really watch it either.
I don't track Nicole Richie that much.
I'm talking about the Mary Kate or whichever one of the Olsons.
I have no idea what you're talking. Okay, well, the Olsen twins, I'm aware of.
Okay, so there's the one of the Olsen twins that was basically bulimic. There's Lois Lane. What's her name?
Kate Bosworth.
All these gals that lately have been starving themselves to death, and their heads look enormous by comparison. They call them bobbleheads.
Okay.
And Christina Ricci is one of the same. Here, she looks way thinner than normal, but not so bad. So she looked, anyway, she looked hot in the trailer. But the trailer looked funny and it looked great. And I remember sitting through Snakes on a Plane going, I kind of wish I was watching that other snake movie with Samuel Jackson.
Well, and I had this down on the list as part of another story we'll talk about, but Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's doing press for World Trade Center,
yep.
Almost every review or anything that mentions Maggie Gyllenhaal lately makes a point of saying, she's not classically beautiful. She's not beautiful. She's not really movie star attractive,
damn.
Which drives me nuts because I never would have thought that before. I think she's hot.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I would have thought she was hot without seeing Secretary. Having seen Secretary,
well,
she's even more hot.
Here's my thinking. Yeah, I remember the first time I ever saw her on Secretary, I remember thinking, wow. I mean, it was an obviously movie. She's naked through a lot of it. And it's kind of humorous where she's having this relationship with her boss that's an S&M relationship and stuff. And it was a really good movie, a funny, weird movie. And she more she goes along, honestly, I feel bad, but I sort of have the same feeling of the reviewers. The more I see her in the movies, the more I find her kind of odd looking. Wouldn't throw her out of bed, wouldn't do that,
it's
but she just kind of she just kind of
very magnanimous.
So it sounds weird, but I was seeing the same thing where you were, and I was secretly going, God, it's awful for them to say that, but I tend to agree.
I think it's ridiculous to say
there's some actor actresses that the first time you see them, people point out that they're not classically, they're weird, and then later they morph into what we define as unbelievably attractive. I'm thinking specifically of what's her name from Lord of the Rings, the ethereal. She was Elizabeth.
Well, Kate Blanchett.
Yeah, Kate Blanchett. When she first came out, especially in Elizabeth, and she looked weird, and people were going, you know, oh my God, what she was weird, and now she's like in many ways she's like totally attractive, but you almost had to get used to her. The other one is Adriana on the Sopranos, whatever her name is. The gal who went on a story on that Joey show.
Mm-hmm.
First time you saw her, it was like, God, there's something about her. It doesn't look right. And then you end up, you get used to it.
I didn't have those reactions to either of those actresses. But
the only reason I bring it up is because both of them specifically, I've heard other people mention it the same way, like on a radio show and other stuff. And I was thinking, God, I had the same exact reaction.
Okay.
You, my friend, are different than most of the population.
Okay.
You are a more generous person in your willingness to find somebody hot initially.
Well, I just find it, you know, nobody would bat an eye if there was some ugly guy.
You're right.
Or not classically attractive guy in a lead role. Why is it necessary to talk about, you know, Maggie Gyllenhaal not being beautiful?
You're exactly right.
I don't want to get into a whole Hollywood sexist thing, but
it's to your credit and the rest of our detriment that we are more judgmental that way.
But all right.
No, I'm not joking. You're exactly right.
So a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I saw Enemy of the State.
Mm-hmm.
It popped up as we were flipping around. And I saw it on the Dish PVR guide.
Tony Scott.
Yeah. And I remember really liking that film. And so I set it to record using the horrible, horrible TiVo sue them over capabilities on AMC, and we start watching it back, and every time I need to stop watching stuff on AMC.
Yeah.
Well, because
they added them.
Because they edit it and they put in commercials, and they didn't used to do that. Like 10 years ago, AMC would run uncut movies.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. Some new business model, which is ridiculous. So start watching this film, which I haven't seen in a while, and it's a lot stupider than I remember it being.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot stupider. Aside, I remember watching, because Jack Black's in it. He's one of the state
one of the guys
techs running the satellites. And he's like, Let me pull it up on a satellite, and you know, and they show you a picture. They show you the same stock shot, not stock shot, but they show you the same shot of a satellite.
Yeah.
Like going across the screen. They use that same shot like 3 times in the movie, which is irritating. Jack Black has this habit in the movie of, you know, they're doing everything through cell phone, and he's like, "I'm on it," and he, you know, dramatically closes the flip phone, and he does that move like 4 times in the movie, and you get a little tired of that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's just because suddenly we're now in much more of a police state than we were when the movie came out, or you start thinking, you know, how is it that just the technical aspects of all of a sudden there's a wireframe of this building within 2 seconds of needing it, and the guy's on the 5th floor and he's running to the 16th floor, and the satellite can perceive this and can do that. And yes, satellites can read license plate numbers from space, but on the other hand,
you know, it made me mad watching that movie too. I had the same reaction because so many reviewers, they kind of called it like a sequel of sorts in feeling to the classic 1974 movie, The Conversation, by Francis Ford Coppola, where Gene Hackman plays this character named Harry Call who records stuff. And that movie, what was so perfect about that was everything was exactly, this is the best you can do at the time with this technology, and them struggling to try and understand these conversations they had secretly recorded. And so they were kind of lumping it, giving it a pass, saying, oh, it's kind of, it has a feel, an emotional feel to like Harry Call was around 25 years later to this is what he's doing now, where he's totally become insular and filming this. And I kept thinking, no, Harry Call was a real character, and this is baloney stuff. And I thought, by the way, the actors were good. I thought Smith was good. I thought Gene Hackman was good. But yeah, I just get so tired of, movie producers will tell you always that no, people give them a pass. As long as you're doing a movie, you throw something in there that may be somewhat real, and they're going to give it a pass. And I'm thinking, God, maybe they're right. But
it's a fine line, because there are times when it's stupid and I buy it and don't care. And then there's times when it pulls me out of the movie.
Well,
the first couple times I saw Enemy of the State, it was stupid and I didn't care and I enjoyed it. This last time I was pulled out and really didn't enjoy it as much.
I'll tell you, every single time I watch CSI, and I love CSI. I know like CSI Miami is your big dumb show, and CSI is my dumb show.
I might drop it this year though.
Well, I like about watching that is I just love all this technical stuff and they go into it, but every single time they need to show they need to like recognize something, it kills me when I hear their words, hey, zoom in on that portion.
Yeah.
And suddenly an 800 by 600 pixel thing becomes this infinitely dense photo that they can pick out. You know, I can't remember one of the shows where they were. Oh,
and especially when it's not even photos, but when it's video.
Exactly. There was like, it was like some ATM video or something. It was like this very low resolution thing, and they go, "We can see the reflection in their cornea," and then they pull out. It was like, wow, the eyeball was literally 4 pixels, and somehow they're pulling out. And I'm thinking, you know, God dang it, that's not just me. That to me, that's the ultimate in lazy writing, because they use it every time, and there's got to be other ways to decide this, or do it like they did Blow Up. You know, have you ever seen Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up? It's this classic movie from the '60s, famously for the first movie ever released, theoretically, at least in the '60s, that had pubic hair in it. And it was like the mod scene in the '60s London. It's by this photographer, took a picture and later realized there may have been a body in his picture, and he keeps blowing it up and blowing it up, and you look closer and you can't tell, God, is that a body, is that not? You're never quite sure what you're looking at. And it was perfect. But on CSI, it's like they blow it up and, oh yeah, nope, I'm sure, because there's a knife sticking out, there's blood there, I can read the handwriting. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's a combination of not just computer tech, but video tech.
Exactly.
And you and I knowing to some degree what's possible and what isn't.
But I get the feeling that people everywhere know. It can't be just us. And so,
well, no, I mean,
or they give it the pass.
Technically aware people would know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think back to like old Law and Order episodes when they were trying to introduce computer aspects to the stories, like, oh, the victim sent an email. And then they like show it on the screen.
Oh,
and they
enormous letters.
Oh, God. And it was so awkward and so bad. And now it seems like the writers have caught up to presenting current tech much more believably. Like, you know, we can track the IP. We can do this with the server. We can do this. We can do that. And you're like, okay, that jibes with what I know actually works on the back end of the internet versus, you're right, a 36-point font email. Point it up, you know, screen by anyway.
Yep.
Moving on. Did you read that interview, that Maurice LaMarche interview I sent you?
No, I didn't. When did you send that to me?
Friday.
Oh, crap. No, you'll have to send me
one of the entertainment blogs I sporadically read is newsfromme.com, and it's this Mark Evanier, I think is how he pronounces his name. It's this cool guy who's done a ton of stuff. He's written some comics. He's a producer and a writer.
Yep.
And he's worked on a ton of shows, and he's got all these great stories about people. And he ran across some interview with Maurice LaMarche on quickstopentertainment.com, which has like a Clerks theme to it. So it's like Quickstop from Clerks.
Letting people know Maurice LaMarche is from Futurama.
Yeah. Well, Maurice LaMarche is a voice actor who's done a lot of things. His most prominent role was the Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Yep.
And
which just came out on DVD.
And it's a long interview, and it's really good. You would enjoy it, because we've talked about voice actors a lot in the past. And he sounds like a really cool guy.
I think every one of those guys on Futurama sounds cool.
And he reinforces what we've talked about in the past, that the voice acting community is really tight and looks out for each other and is really cool in general. Telling a story about how when the voice actors for the Simpsons were renegotiating their contracts, Fox went out and tried to get other voice actors to read for the roles.
Yep.
And they tried to get Maurice LaMarche to read for Hank Azaria and Harry Shearer's roles, and he said, no, those characters are those actors, you know, those actors do those characters. Unless A, they're dead, or B, they don't want to do them anymore, I'm not going to read for those parts. Wow. And in part because of that, the Simpsons voice actors won their battle.
Yeah, an enormous contract.
And it sounds like most voice actors are like that. They're really protective of saying, no, that role belongs to this person. And as long as they want to do it, I'm not going to read for it if you're having a contract dispute for them. And it's so cool. Pardon the phrase, heartwarming to read that. And anyway.
I noticed when I was looking at, I got my Boondocks DVD, and I noticed in the credits, the lead actors, it's mostly African-American folks, but a lot of the supplemental voices on the back every week, you've got Billy West, and you've got, there's another Futurama person.
John DiMaggio?
Yeah, John DiMaggio. They're both in there. Also, Jill Talley is a regular character from Mr. Show. And then they only have a couple, like, actual people like Charlie Murphy and Ed Asner who are non voice actors, but it was a good mix, and it was cool to see, you know, that it's a working gig in Hollywood, that sometimes you're lead, sometimes you're not, and it was kind of
cool.
Well,
voice actors make their money on mostly work for scale, but if they do enough gigs, that's where they
or
make
if you
it up.
Luck into a like a long
right
gig.
Like
Simpsons.
Brian Talley.
Jill Talley's husband. No,
we screw this up every time. I can't ever remember this guy's
SpongeBob
name.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, but we should know him because he was on Mr. Show.
Yeah, but it's not Talley. But that's his.
God,
wife.
That's embarrassing that we've forgotten his name in the past, and we should know it because we knew him before he was.
The funny
big.
Thing is we know exactly what he looks like. Yeah. We can picture in our mind.
All right, next up, you forwarded me the story about Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, yeah, I had no idea.
This movie
Paul
called
Thomas...
There Will Be Blood. I had heard the title before, and I thought, well, that sounds dumb. That sounds like a Roger Corman movie.
I heard the title, and I thought, oh, that's kind of a cool title. It reminds me of that band name. It was the stupidest band name, but it's like my favorite all time. The band name was... what is it? And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead or something like that. But anyway, it's Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis. I have no idea what this is about.
Yeah, I've seen the title before, so it's not like it's a complete surprise, but in terms of awareness, it's, oh, cool, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Because
he's
an incredible director. There's nothing he's done that I haven't been anything less than enjoyed and often totally loved. And Daniel Day-Lewis is about the best actor in the world. And he's a guy that sits down and will wait years between projects and go apparently be a cobbler in Florence or whatever. But when he does a role, even the occasional ones that aren't that interesting, like he did this role with his wife a couple years ago, his wife directed a movie and it was kind of dumb. But oh my God, Gangs of New York, he was so good in that movie and The Boxer and all these other movies. He's so good that I don't know what that combination is like, because he's an actor that just becomes a role, and I'm not so sure how that mixes into the Paul Thomas Anderson world. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes, but I'm looking forward to it big time.
For whatever reason, when I think of Daniel Day-Lewis, I think of Gangs of New York, yes, as well as Last of the Mohicans, for a variety of reasons, because I haven't seen that movie in a while. It's a good movie. I really liked the last 20 minutes of that movie.
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really, really well done. But there was this line in the movie where, you know, he's leading a few people somewhere, and then a British soldier catches up with them and says, "Well, how is it that you're headed headed away from this battle?" And he says, "How is it that you're headed west?" You know, and the guy says, "Well, you head north, and you turn left, real sudden like." I thought that was always a really well delivered joke.
That's one of those classic movies they put on DVD in the early era of DVD. And so it's a very widescreen movie, but it's not anamorphic.
And the other thing about it is I can remember one of the few things I remember from high school really specifically is the English teacher handing out the short piece from Mark Twain, The Literary Offenses of James Fenimore Cooper.
Yeah.
A lot of which, if not the whole thing, had to do with certain parts of Last of the Mohicans, the actual story, which were completely retarded.
Yeah.
And so after having reading this, and of course now I can't remember more than one or two points, thinking, wow, that's right. That's completely retarded and makes no sense. And so now I kind of view this movie as weird reaction to it, even though I don't remember how closely the book or the movie adheres to the book.
Well, when we were in college, I don't know if you ended up reading this in any of your classes, but one of our professors handed out this short piece by this African writer named Chinua Achebe, and the piece is talking about Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and he effectively makes a very convincing case that A, Joseph Conrad is a racist, and B, Heart of Darkness is not that well written, even though everybody says Joseph Conrad was this brilliant writer. And it's unbelievably effective piece by Chinua Achebe, and it killed me because Heart of Darkness was my favorite book, my favorite piece of literature, and it effectively ruined that book for me because it was so effective, and I so wish I hadn't read that. And I know a lot of people love James Fenimore Cooper. I'm sure Mark Twain has, with that piece, because it's so famous, has had more of a deleterious effect on the reputation of James Fenimore Cooper by pointing out stuff, but by being such an effective writer himself that it's hard to ever look at Fenimore Cooper the same way again. So, anyway.
Okay, next bit. Just randomly yesterday, I saw that Ain't It Cool had links to pictures to the Transformers.
Oh, from the really?
Apparently,
didn't get pulled off the web immediately?
Not yet. So I haven't checked Ain't It Cool News this morning to see if they were hoaxes, because usually if something's a hoax, it's they find out in 24 hours.
Or, because remember, they had a couple other images that immediately image removed at the request of the company. So,
and anyway, these were apparently pictures from the toys.
Yep.
Like toy presentations from, Hasbro or whoever, but doesn't matter. And so you'd see, they weren't that high res, but pictures, you know, here's Optimus Prime in truck cab mode, and here's what the robot will look like. Here's what a helicopter, robot and helicopter looks like. And here's Bumblebee as a robot, although that wasn't a toy picture, that was from some other source. And it's hard to tell if they're legit, because the robot versions look very intricate, like much more so than just blandly copying what the toys did. And you're looking at it going, wow, there's a lot of eye candy here that is visually interesting. I don't know if it's legit, and if it's not, it's still kind of fun to look at anyway. Mm-hmm. If it is legit, it's, you know, really, really makes you think, how are they effectively going to show a robot transforming into a car or a helicopter or a plane or a tank or whatever? And how are they dealing with the systems of an engine? How are they dealing with the drive? You know, they're not going to show the electrical chassis connections being severed or moving or anything. But
my hope is they do it and it feels real. There's nothing I mean, you see an ad where they'll all of a sudden show a car turn and transform, and it's all a cheat. If you just it's like a third of a second transition where all of a sudden some big portion of a car becomes some other portion.
Right.
But it's a complete cheat, and you end up going, see, that there's no possible. It's funny to watch this big dancing robot.
Which kind of reminds me of the first episode of the Clerks animated series. Uh-huh. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. I have the series. I should
the
watch
five, it. I mean, the last couple minutes of it.
I remember about that series is the bear show. The funniest thing ever.
Well, they that's the sequence. The last couple minutes of the first episode they broadcast went into this weird like a Korean anime thing.
It was so funny.
Where they had dancing robots, and it was this little riff on the Transformers where they're driving along and suddenly they transform into robots, but the people inside were crushed and there's this blood dripping out.
Right.
Who is dancing? Bear is dancing.
That's right. Who is dancing?
Our coworker Robin thought that was hysterical,
that.
And she loved that bit. But yeah, it's the legitimate, how are they legitimately going to transform something? And you're right. Do they do it from a real standpoint or do they do it from a stylized standpoint? Anyway, if you're interested, it's good eye candy to look at.
You know, sometimes I wonder with some of these images, you remember when Godzilla came out, when it was going to be the big movie, and they specifically sent out about five different mock-ups to some of their potential suppliers of what Godzilla was going to look like, and most of them looked like the classic Godzilla. And when all of a sudden some bootleg merchandise started coming out ahead of it with this other design, they knew exactly which of their suppliers had broken their agreement, and then they canceled all their contracts.
That's smart.
Yeah, well, it was. And it was because at the time, nobody knew what Godzilla was going to look like, but they certainly, everybody was assuming it was going to be like classic Godzilla.
I mean,
Godzilla.
And not that that's, I mean, certainly with closely held scripts, you know, there's watermarks on the specific pages, or the script is printed on a special color paper with a special color font so that it won't Xerox, or if it does get copied, you know, if it does get copied, then they'll know which version of the script it's from and who had that version and can track it down. And I always think that's really smart. Like, there's some video, I think Halo 2 testing was done like that, where early people that were doing playtesting on Halo 2, there were things that were scrolling across the screen or a crawl you couldn't get rid of, so that if you tried to videotape it and put it on the web, unless you cropped this out, they did something to the screen where you couldn't tape it without them knowing who did it. And I thought, that's really, from a copy protection standpoint, really smart.
Well, speaking of that, you know, it's starting to drive me nuts. Every movie, you know, the new technology, and I don't blame him for doing this, but the new technology, every movie pretty much that's in a theater, randomly every 15 to 20 minutes, they, for one frame, they will burn in a series of dots. And each one of those dots is specific to a specific theater. So if somebody films them, and I see them every movie.
I've talked to so many people who've never seen them.
I see them every time, like in Snakes on a Plane, I counted them five times. And I know there's probably more, but you'll just be sitting there seeing, and all of a sudden it would almost be like a persistence of memory thing. You're seeing like a dot, like one dot, another below. It looks like Braille. And basically,
well, is it superimposed onto a frame of the movie, or is it against a neutral background?
It's burned onto the frame of the film, and it's not on it. Just sometimes it's more obvious than others.
I've never noticed that.
There was like a couple like did it where they did it right against a white background, so it was real obvious. But you know, you're typical. Most people I know have a nose. I see them every time.
Supposed to see Talladega Nights right after I leave here.
Look close for them because it'll definitely be there.
Right.
Anyway, it's starting to drive me nuts, and I understand it.
And it's
I don't understand
like,
why
you know,
they're
it's
doing
things
it.
Like that, or you know, cigarette burns, which is the phrase used for the
little corner
the,
thing,
the hole in the film that looks like a hole in the right upper right hand corner of the film every 20 minutes, which designates a reel change, harkens back to the days when you had two projectors per booth, and projectionist up there literally turning on one projector at the right point, and would alternate every 20 minutes. And nowadays, you assemble the film, you splice it together, so it's all sitting on a platter, and cigarette burns don't really serve a purpose anymore.
Yeah.
But once you notice them, and especially when you know what they're for, you really notice them. And it's things like that, or a green scratch in a film is much more damaging to the actual film than a black scratch.
Yeah.
I can't remember why, but I remember that from working in a theater. And things like that that just pull you out of the movie for a minute, and it's like it's a little too behind the scenes. You're like, oh, I know a little too much about it now. I can't enjoy it quite as much.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, another story. I don't know exactly how recent this is. For new listeners, we don't restrict ourselves to new stories.
No.
We'll go back, as I did with Enemy of the State, and talk about something that's 10 years old. This isn't that old. Lucasfilm has given its blessing to all the Star Wars parodies things appearing on YouTube.
Yep.
That's awesome.
I know, I love
that.
That
is so cool. You know, for someone who's such a weirdo about versions of Star Wars, and no, that version doesn't exist. This new version is the official
version.
But
he's been doing that for a while, as long as people don't try to make money on it,
yeah.
Right?
So it's not like a new thing, but this official sanctioning of YouTube.
That is very cool.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that is the way to do it. Creativity. And you don't come off like an ogre or,
well,
pun intended, Darth Vader.
And you know, Star Trek did that too. And Star Trek was famously...
Well, Paramount.
Paramount, you're right. And Paramount was famously... they were the ones that, in the early, early days of the internet, sent all these injunctions out to these websites. In retrospect, holy geez, they were trying to shut down sites that even talked about Star Trek. Not just imagery, but just in general. And then later they realized, God, what are we, crazy? So now, and you've got that, you know, there's that on Howard Stern, every once in a while they bring on George Takei as an announcer, and they goof on him and talk to him, and he's cool, and they love him, and he loves me on
the
show.
Is it actually George Takei?
Oh, God, yes. Okay, it's definitely George Takei.
We have a local celebrity, John Curley, who does an evening magazine show, and the show itself is... It's kind of sappy, and I never watch it because it's not aimed at our demographic at all.
No.
And I would probably hate the show, but the guy himself, Curly, is hysterical.
I think he's incredible, but so many people hate him.
We've both met him off camera.
He's funny, total ADD guy.
And he does this George Takei impression, which is literally rolling on the floor laughing hysterical.
Oh, you mean on the mountain, like with the...
Well, I don't think he restricts it to there, but...
I just never heard of him.
He does a George Takei impression, which you'll pee your pants. It's so funny. Anyway.
No, this is definitely the real George Takei, but he was talking about in September he's coming back to New York because he's going to be filming one of these Star Trek, you know, these Star Trek fan movies.
What's his face did that?
Another Star Trek actor?
Walter Koenig.
Yeah, I was stunned. I didn't realize, and he apparently, they may be paying him a little bit for
They wrote
him.
It up in Wired. It's fan-produced TV. Fans are making their own original series Star Trek episodes for no budget, but apparently they're pretty good.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I did see one a little bit, and it was very good, except for the acting. You end up realizing...
Yeah, and that's why I'm a huge Trek fan, and yet I have no interest in seeking that out because of that.
Oh, it was really kind of embarrassing, and I was watching, I was going, you know, you're putting this together. The problem with these things is they're so into making a real Star Trek experience, but so much about that is getting themselves as Captain Kirkware.
And it's got to be the hardest thing, because it's not easy to be an actor, or it's not easy to be in front of a camera.
Well,
suddenly you flip a switch in your head and you're... Brr.
Well, my feeling is they should realize that, boy, we're doing this. The effects look so great and everything for some fan-produced thing, that they really should go down to their local... you know, a drama site or whatever, and try and get somebody else to be part of it,
too.
Anyway.
There was a Wells on Hollywood Elsewhere linked to a column that someone else had written, I think. I don't know if it was the Times or the Post, or I don't know where it was originally. but this article about Warner Brothers and Superman and Bryan Singer. Did you read that?
Maybe.
I didn't send it to you, but maybe. I just kind of assume that you see everything on Wells anyway.
Maybe.
It was a really good article about how Bryan Singer, who was in negotiations to direct X3,
yep.
the third X-Men film with Fox.
Yep.
And Singer was looking to make some money with this one.
Yep.
And the chairman of Fox was, they were going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And Warner Brothers comes in and says, hey, how about we give you a ton of money and you come over here and direct Superman? And he says, I would love to do a Superman film. I would love to have a ton of money. I think I'll do that. And the article was basically saying, you know what? You can look at X3 as making a ton of money and being a clear success, maybe not a critical success, but a money-making success. And you can look at Superman Returns as being profitable, but not being the blockbuster they wanted. Excuse me. But Warner Brothers now has Bryan Singer. And they're more than likely going to do a second film, and it's going to be a lot cheaper than the first one. Because they don't have to spend, for a variety of reasons.
And as Bryan Singer puts it, it's getting all Wrathicon on his whatever.
Yeah, but I'm going to let that go. They're going to do the money for less money. They'll have a little more fiscal responsibility, but they have Bryan Singer at Warner Brothers now, and they really, really like him as a director. They think he's a good tentpole director. They think he's a good director to bank on for the next couple of years. Whereas you look at X3, the X-Men films are, by and large, they're in a transition period. You could say they're not going to make another X-Men movie with the same actors because it would cost them way too much money.
Yep.
Even though they're doing a Wolverine film, they're going to do a young Magneto film.
Yep.
But that's not the same thing as an X-Men film. Maybe maybe they'll make the same amount of money. But, you know, Brett Ratner isn't going to make, probably isn't going to make as much money for Fox as Singer will for Warner Brothers. So anyway, the point of this article was, it may look like Warner Brothers got the short end of the stick when you compare the money, the returns of Superman versus X-Men, but really Warner Brothers got the director they wanted, and you have to look beyond that.
Yeah. So yeah, I love Bryan Singer, and but it was weird though, that at least in the initial days after Superman, there was a lot of carping and a lot of, about Bryan Singer, and they were sort of and there was some of the reports where Bryan Singer was mad at, or he didn't like how one thing was promoted or whatever. And
yeah I've started to hear some marketing backlash, and I heard, well, dude, you made a point of saying in the Wired article you approved, or you were involved in every aspect
exactly
of the
that was what was looking
the
at that.
Maybe it was the licensing.
Well, I mean, they made the point that even he was going so far as to doing the milk ad that we hated. And so it was a little bit of, you know, if it's not doing too successful, you just got to bite the bullet and not complain. George Clooney had the best thing ever about it. When he was in, he talked about he loves talking about how he killed Batman. And he says, you know, how it was all this and that. And he says, you know, I was in Batman. It was terrible. You know, honestly, and he says in the retrospect, there was a million reasons why Batman was terrible, but I got the blame. You know, that's the way it works. Now, a couple years later, I just happened to be in, and I think he was talking about like Out of Sight or something. And he was saying, and I was good in it, but there was no whatever, but I got all the credit for this. And I just looked at, like, you know, it's never appropriate, and you just got to go along with it. And I thought, that's the attitude you got to take. Don't sit there while it's going on and get defensive, because there's times when you get credit for something you don't deserve. So when you're getting blamed for something you don't totally deserve, just, it's a career. Go on with it. But anyway, but I haven't sensed that much of Bryan Singer. I love the guy so much. He's such an awesome
and
director.
I really wish, I hope there was some chatter a couple of months ago that maybe he wouldn't make Logan's Run. And I was like, no, dude, you have to make Logan's Run.
So, but I thought he definitely wasn't. I thought that was totally on hold. Or is it back to go?
Well, the article mentions that he's making another movie before the next Superman movie, and it might be Logan's Run. It might be this other thing.
Yeah.
Which I can't remember what it is now, but I really want to see
Logan's
Singer,
Run,
Logan's
yet
Run.
Another movie that in a throwaway thing in The Simpsons has kind of... You know, there's that scene where the MTV VJ also looks at her
dot.
Blinking hand, and she's 26 years old.
God, that was funny.
And I thought, and just instantly, it to some extent, the Simpsons is really good for taking cherished memories of youth, of shows and things that seemed a lot better and more prominent than they were, and instantly piercing their bubble, so you are to take them seriously.
Yeah, to me, that didn't pierce the Logan's bubble,
because it was kind of a small reference, but yeah. It's still a little bit on that. Anyway,
all right, cross that off the list here.
Does your list include my new Apocalypse Now DVD?
I've got new DVDs okay. in the list. We're getting there. I got a bitch here.
Okay.
At Fandango.
Oh yeah.
My buddy John and I were, we try and do something every week or so, and let's get together this weekend. Okay, sure. I was like, oh, well, I think The Illusionist is opening this weekend. You want to see that? And he's like, yes, I do. I was like, great. Let's try and see The Illusionist this weekend.
Yep.
And turns out, not opening in Seattle. You go to Fandango, and right, it usually lists the movies opening that weekend on the left-hand side. The Illusionist opens everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It hasn't opened everywhere if it hasn't opened in Seattle.
Seattle's a big enough market to be included.
I don't know if it was
everywhere
LA, New York only, or if it's LA, New York, and San Francisco, but damn
it's
it.
Weird in this
I was
age.
Stoked to see The Illusionist, and I was pissed when it wasn't there.
The thing at its world premiere in Seattle, for God's sakes, you would think that it would open here, at the literate city that we are film-wise.
Yes, we are. Anyway, that's my bitch at Fandango.
It's got some pretty good reviews. I heard some negative reviews early on.
I heard it wasn't as good as The Prestige.
But increasingly now, I've seen a lot of really good reviews of it. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it, too.
I was at a concert last night, and it struck me as it's got to be really weird to be in a band or to do something similar where if you're not at that moment writing a CD or recording a CD or writing the songs, and you're in a band and you fly out to a city to do a gig, you're not touring, but it's like, you don't really do anything all week, and your entire work is a 1.5 hour performance out of the whole week.
Yeah.
That's your job. And I'm not saying they're not working hard or they're not working as much as, I've got a standard 40-hour a week job. But the mental, how you deal with that mentally has got to be so different. Like, I go in, I put in my 8 hours. I'm like, thank God I get to go home now. And this guy or someone in a band, all they did all week was play for 1.5 hours.
Life is good.
Well, and it's so different.
Well, you know,
it's this mental.
But the people to really compare it to are comedians. Because they have that same gig where almost all their shows are on weekends.
Well, I don't want to restrict it to artists and bands, but yeah. it got me thinking about how there's a lot of entertainment related jobs where this the workflow is so different than what most people are used to.
Yeah.
I have a very standard 40-hour a week job. You have like a 60, 70-hour a week job where it just you're insane about the time you put into your job because that's who you are.
I'm an idiot.
But you contrast that to when you're on stage for 1.5 hours a week or every 2 weeks or a month versus, granted, when you're recording a CD, there's a lot of work in that. Or you're writing something and you've got to deal with a blank piece of paper. You're starting from scratch. Like, what's a good guitar riff? Or you talk about comedians having to come up with a new set. Where you're looking at that comedian movie with Jerry Seinfeld and that other guy. The process of both of them coming up with comedic material.
Yep.
And that would be really hard because then the onus is on you to not goof off. You have to decide, I need to come up with new material from this hour to this hour today versus I need to enjoy myself and not be working this hour, or you spend all of your time coming up with new material and you don't give yourself that vacation of I've done 8 hours of work today, I'm done. I'm gonna goof off and do something else. Go for a hike, blob and watch The Daily Show versus that it consumes your life where you can't rest until you've come up with a 45-minute set of material. It's got to be just
well, a lot of those comedians, you'll hear them, when they've got their, when they've developed it and they've got their thing and they're going from town to town and their life, and they describe it, it's always the same. Their life is exactly the same. First of all, they have to get up very friggin' early because they got to go on morning radio shows to promote the show. So when you have
actually with comedians, it's true. Comedians do a lot of live call-ins or go in, but more and more when you're hearing interviews on morning radio, those are pre-taped.
I know, that's what kind of sucks. But at least because it's fun to hear them live. But anyway, they'll describe they're going and doing this, And then they basically sit around and they're in a town and they have nothing to do because they can't really go anywhere far. And a lot of comedians, they just say, you know, I just go to town, and others you'll hear, they'll say, no, I love doing this because then I'm going to go find out what to do in the town, and they're tourists.
Yeah.
But for the most part, they just get bored and depressed.
I would enjoy exploring new towns and new downtowns, exactly, and new areas.
Wouldn't it be cool to, like, I've never been to Denver. I've never been to Boston. I would love to go do that kind of stuff.
And I would too. But I have sympathy for where they're coming from. And God, a lot of times I listen to comedians do morning shows or do call-in, and I don't enjoy it,
yeah,
because I have heard a lot of comedy. I know a lot of routines. I can quote you lines. It's one of my things that I do. But you listen to comedians do live call-ins, and they're just doing pieces of their set.
Yeah.
And they've told the host, you know what, feed me a line about, yeah, working out. And suddenly you're hearing the guy's, you know, extemporaneously going on about working out. And really, it's just the guy's set joke worked in to sound like he's coming up with it on the thing. And I always feel kind of bad for the radio host because they probably know the joke and they kind, yeah, of have to laugh like, ha, 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 I just heard that for the first time. That's funny. Instead of, I've heard that on your CD 5-6 times.
Yeah. And it's funny because there's some comedians, they're actually not even necessarily the best comedians, but they're really good about being on radio shows, and you learn to appreciate them. And there's some that, you're right, that's all they do is their set. Like I'll listen to, as you know, Howard Stern, and he'll have Lisa Lampanelli, who's this new insult comic, basically. And she's funny, but it's a parade of her set insults. Versus she'll have some other comedians like Greg Giraldo and some others that are, or Jimmy Kimmel. There are so funny. And it's so clearly just at the top of their head.
I wasn't going to name names, but Greg Giraldo is actually one of the guys I've heard who does his set when he calls in. I love Greg Giraldo. I think he's hysterical. But when I hear him do live radio stuff, to me, it's like he's doing his set.
Well, maybe it's different at Howard Stern, because Howard Stern, it's always about reality or whatever. So he's asking about his alcoholism.
But granted, it could be that, you know, when you wake up at 5 a.m, you're not creative enough to be improvising, and you just you slip into the comfort zone of your, yeah, set jokes. So I'm not gonna be too mean on these guys because I understand where they're coming, yeah, from. But if that's tough, the reason, but
I'll tell you, on Howard Stern, he's very funny because he's real, and they have, yeah. Anyway, I totally hear where you're coming from.
All right, let's talk about your new DVDs.
Well, I have one very big one I've been waiting for many, many years.
I'm going to turn off the fan while you talk about that.
Okay. I'm getting a little cold. Sorry. Well, they finally released Apocalypse Now, the new version with a commentary track. And for the most part, it's everything I was hoping for on this DVD. It was, Apocalypse Now is my second favorite movie of all time. In fact, I'm almost tempted to say, why do I always put Lawrence of Arabia above this movie? Because I think it is my favorite movie, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so it's a DVD. And what's cool is they show both the original version and the Redux version. And they have two commentary tracks, one for each version, or so they advertised, until you find out later. No, it's just
spliced in new
commentary.
Yeah, I would have been...
Yeah. Well, but the funny thing was, is the way they advertised when Apocalypse Now Redux came out four years ago, they said, we went back to the elements and we re-edited everything. This is a totally new movie. We added new stuff, but we really made sure the rest of the stuff was right. And I thought, I don't know why they did that, but I guess they did that. Well, in reality, they didn't do that. They just added in like three separate new scenes. That said, you know, Coppola is a really... he's a generous guy in his commentary tracks. He is constantly talking about his collaborators and whose ideas it was. And the movie is just friggin' brilliant. Although it's kind of weird that watching it, it bursts some illusions and other stuff. You know, that movie, there was no credits in the beginning or end. It just started and ended.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
And I remember when I saw that movie at the Stanley Theater in Vancouver, BC, the 70mm Roadshow version, and it was the first movie I'd ever seen, and one of the first movies ever that had quadraphonic sound, and it was so incredible hearing these sounds from all around you. It was just an amazing performance, and they gave you this little booklet, because they had to give you credit somehow, so they would hand out credits in the booklet. And So anyway, but apparently, according to this movie, you'd always hear the thing in the movie where the name came from. They said, "Oh, if you look, when they get to the final scene in the, you know, at the big compound, that there's some graffiti written on the cement, you know, or on a pylon that says Apocalypse Now. Our motto is Apocalypse Now." And they always say, "Well, the movie is named after this graffiti," and it's like, not quite. Apparently, legally, if you produce any work of art and you want it copyrighted, you have to have a title somewhere. So apparently they literally spray painted that on there so the movie would have a title. Of course, it was 2 hours into the movie, but legally said, yeah, there's a title. And basically saying, if you look real close, there's also a copyright symbol there, too.
That's funny.
Oh, unbelievable. So and then there was some other stuff, too. You know, that movie has the best. You know, famously, that movie starred Harvey Keitel as Willard, the guy who goes up the river. And a month into filming, what's his name? Coppola fired Harvey Keitel because Harvey Keitel was this big, brash New York actor full of acting tics and other stuff, a good actor. But he realized I needed a cipher, a guy that doesn't do anything in this role. And that's why I hired Martin Sheen. And Martin Sheen's brilliant in this role. But at the time, I didn't realize, you know, I always thought Harvey Keitel. And now I realize, oh, that would have ruined it. Some big, you know, De Niro kind of actor in there. But the best thing about that movie, I always thought was the voiceover. And it's always great. I mean, the opening line, and I won't say the full thing, but he always, you know, he wakes up in this room and he goes, "Saigon." And he says S word and I love that. And then there's other commentary track and it's so, or our voiceover, it's so perfect. Well, they're showing in the scenes behind the scenes, they're showing the making of, and you're seeing Martin Sheen wearing this like sweater with his like dress shirt underneath recording those commentary tracks. And it totally bursts the illusion. He's sitting here in this, like in this room, you know, with the recording studio and
President Bartlett.
Yeah. It was like so weird, you know. And the other thing too, the movie above all else was a great audio achievement. It was brilliant because they were creating quadraphonic sound and all this stuff that had never been even done in movies before ever. And they were also incorporating an electronic synthesizer soundtrack, The Doors soundtrack, a classic soundtrack, melding it all together. And that's incredible enough. And then they showed some background scenes of them in the mixing recording studio. And I didn't realize this, but in the old days, I mean, the all the tapes were so loud and the machines are so loud that essentially these guys are sitting up front in the mixing studio and then they go into a microphone, get helicopter track B-17X3 loaded up. And then they go in the back and there's these guys, these five guys in the back in this sweaty studio filled with machines where they're loading up actual tracks and pulling out pieces of audio. And it just looked like an incredible enterprise that nowadays one person with a digital thing would do it very easily. It just an incredible achievement. And watching this DVD was incredible. The only downside to it is that, you know, there is and I've told you before, there's a very famous, great documentary about the making of it called Hearts of Darkness. And this DVD, and it's all about the making of it, how crazy, you know, Coppola is. And you get the distinct impression this DVD, at one point they thought about putting that documentary as part of the DVD because all of the extras are not about the making of the movie. It's all about post-production and what happened after the movie. And there's this big hole of, well, where's the scenes of them making it? Where's the scenes of this and that? Ah. And you get the distinct impression they had thought about it and decided not to. So anyway, nonetheless, it was brilliant. It was incredible to see the movie again. And I always remember the first version of it came out in DVD and they have the very beginning of the movie, they have this very famous slow motion helicopter sound of this sound. And the thing circles around your stereo in quadraphonic stereo, and the very first movie they use that as the looped menu track, so when the movie's over it goes back to that. And I remember watching it, falling asleep in my room with my little quadraphonic stereo, and that whole night I was hearing that going and circling around my head, and it totally, it infiltrated every one of my dreams, and it was nightmares and dreams and everything else. And so that whole thing, it just, it's like now part of my cerebral core, you know, that, that whole sound. Funny. Anyway, so I'm very excited to have the Apocalypse Now on DVD. It's like a, it's a really awesome DVD, and it was really cool to see.
Cool. not too much
now
left.
I'm just waiting for Reds, and then my DVD collection will be complete of movies.
I'm going to do this special homage to Richard's 1,000 DVD collections. Once
there.
You pass that big
about
number
30 away.
You know what I'm starting to get excited about? I've been purposefully not thinking about it. Yep. Starting to get excited about Battlestar Galactica coming back in October.
You know, I was meaning to just download the whole damn thing in iTunes so I could watch it, and now I it's even cheaper to buy it on the DVD. So
I have to check into that, because they did some bull crap with Best Buy having a special version, which I hate.
Yeah.
I hate, you know, I hate encouraging that behavior.
Yeah, but they did that with Office Space too. It made me mad.
Yeah, and I have to look into what versions are out there, because I should do that as well. But I'm getting excited for finally seeing some new Battlestar Galactica.
Cool.
So I've been ignoring a lot of stuff about spoiler warnings and what's going to happen here and what's going to happen there, and I'm excited about that.
Cool.
Let's see what else. Next week we're going to PAX.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
That's going to be wild.
The
Penny Arcade Expo.
Yep, Penny Arcade.
Bunch of gaming dorks.
I know.
And we're only going on Saturday. So
yeah, but there's a lot of cool little.
It's going to be the busiest day. It's going to be wall to wall nerds in there.
I know, nerd fest. But there's going to be there's a lot of cool panels. I was looking into it. Like, it's like, this is cool. This is like really my cup of tea. I'm going to be in that.
It'll be interesting. And I just now thought of, there was an Onion story. Basically, a girl was at a Farscape convention and ended up getting an inflated self-worth, an inflated self-opinion of herself because of all the attention she was getting.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so we'll talk about that on Sunday, because we're going on Saturday.
Saturday, yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
The PAX show. That'll be really cool. I'm going to see Talladega Nights this afternoon, which you were invited to, but you have to go do a work thing.
No, I'm not going to do a work thing. I'm going to take the Boeing family tour.
Family tour. I thought you were going to Boeing as setting up a table, which
was funny
on a weekend, but
no, it's the old annual, they open up Boeing for the friends and family.
That would be cool.
Yeah. You're invited too, but you're already going. I'll let you know next year ahead of time.
Yeah.
But it's cool, 'cause you get to see where they're making the 747s, and it's not the tour. So it's like,
yeah,
'cause
I've been on the tour.
Yeah.
Although it was a while ago.
Yeah. It's pretty fun.
Every often you stop and think about the fact that, you know, we live in this area, you know, all the Boeing jets are made either in Renton, just a little bit south of us, or in Everett, which is it still the biggest building?
Far and away, it was the biggest, and then they almost doubled the size.
Well, because it's by volume, right?
Yeah, by volume.
There's some qualifying term, which clearly there's some other building which is bigger in some other way.
Well, it was the biggest in the world, and then when they did when they opened the 777 line, they almost doubled the size of it. So it's like, you know, it's ginormous, to use the correct term.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just cool that the Boeing factory is so close to us.
It is cool. And it's cool to work with all these people, because I don't think there's a single Boeing worker that doesn't hate Boeing and grumble about Boeing.
Really?
So it's funny that, well, they all just did.
A bunch of my friends worked there out of college, but then they didn't go back after the SPIA strike.
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, it's a classic big company and they're the union people, but it's so funny to go to the family day because all the Boeing workers, they grumble and hate, but it's their life, and they love grumbling about Boeing.
Well,
so
I love to, every time I see the word Boeing, I mentally have to go boing, and I interviewed there.
That's right, a while ago,
and
Boeing, a Chicago company, as they always say in the new articles. I still can't get over that.
That was the biggest stupid. Anyway,
idiots.
Yeah, I interviewed there, and I would have loved that job.
Yeah,
I would have loved that job, but it was pretty funny. Midway through the interview, I think it was clear that the head interviewer, because it was a team interview with this group, the head interviewer suddenly realized that the organization I worked for at the time was not as large as she thought it was.
Oh.
And so she didn't think my experience was as relevant. And I was like, actually, no, it is, and I'd be good at this, but I could sort of see the switch in her head where suddenly she didn't care anymore. Yeah. And I was like, oh, nuts. Anyway, so you're doing that. I'm doing Talladega Nights. I don't know if there's anything else this week. Is anything open Friday?
God, I don't know.
Maybe the Illusionist in Seattle.
I don't know. Oh, you know the other trailer I saw in front of Snakes on Plane?
No, I
didn't. Tenacious D and the Picadesque. Dancing on the Web. You know what's funny? It's a funny trailer. It's a funny trailer. They're clearly, but it's all big, brash, over the top, you know, quick snippets of comedy, you know, where it's not really funny, except for the very end, there's a funny joke. But it's clear they're trying to figure out how the hell do we introduce this thing to people.
Okay.
And they do a pretty good job, and it's clearly going to be a great, funny, hilarious movie. But the trailer, it's sort of like a, you know, 2 second snippet here of this dumb thing, 2 second, it's a wild, wacky movie, and this is going on because they can't figure out how else to do something that's clearly over the top, where they're trying to get this guitar pick from the devil and all this other stuff. So, but it was cool.
Right on. I'll have to look that up. All right, we should probably wrap it up. Like we talked about Boeing for 5 minutes. I think we're about out of topic.
Definitely out of time. In fact, let's see what time. Wow, this is our longest podcast ever. An hour and 15.
Ouch. All right, well, thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, something you'd like us to address, you can send an email to youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com.
Two N's. Is it two N's?
Yeah, mayonnaise has two N's in it.
Yep.
Our website is mustardayonnaise.com, although really all that's there is the feed to the audio and then like a brief description of what's in the show.
We'll work on it.
Eventually that site will get better, but... And that's it. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
That's it.
Thanks.